too.
Have you gotten your flu shot? It's never too late to protect yourself, your family, and your community against the flu. This year, it is more important than ever. Black and African Americans, people of color, pregnant people, people without health insurance or a regular health care provider, people with pre-existing conditions like asthma, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease, and people 65 and older are encouraged to get a flu shot. Multnomah County Health Department and Portland Community College are hosting a free weekly drive-through flu vaccine and COVID-19 testing clinic that will be held every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. until March 31, 2021, at PCC's Cascade Campus, Parking Lot 1, located at 701 North Jessup Street in Portland. Entrance is on North Albina Street. You can drive through, bike through, or walk up to. To reserve an appointment for a flu shot or COVID test, call 503-988-8939. That's 503-988-8939. This campaign is a project of the Racial and Ethnic Approaches to Community Health and the Communicable Disease Services programs. It is made possible with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Public Service Announcements.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, the House debated and voted on an article of impeachment against President Donald Trump over his role in inciting a domestic terror attack against lawmakers at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. With less than 10 days to go before he leaves office, Trump was the target of angry denunciations from House Democrats who accused him of being a danger to the nation. Lawmakers remain shaken by the horrific attack last week that left 5 people dead. As of this recording, the hearing continues, but Democrats who hold a majority in the House are likely to prevail in their efforts, making Trump the first president in the history of the nation to be impeached twice. Here is House Speaker Nancy Pelosi addressing the House early on Wednesday.
I know that the President of the United States incited this insurrection, this armed rebellion against our common country. He must go. He is a clear and present danger to the nation that we all love.
House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer also spoke, citing the words of his Republican colleague Liz Cheney, who Trump had targeted by name in his Capitol Hill speech shortly before his supporters launched their attack.
And she said this as well. There has never been a greater betrayal by a president of the United States of his office and his oath of Constitution to the Constitution. This is not, as Liz Cheney says, just some action. She characterizes it as the biggest betrayal of any president of the United States in our history.
That's House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer quoting Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney, who is one of several GOP lawmakers joining Democrats to impeach Trump. Democratic Representative Jim McGovern accused other Trump-supporting Republicans of aiding and abetting the president.
Some of my Republican friends have been trying to lecture us about unity here today. Unity, after they voted to overturn a free and fair election in the United States of America, but also preaching unity and not acknowledging that for 4 years, many of them gave oxygen to Donald Trump's conspiracy theories, to the big lies. They turned the other way in the face of racism and bigotry and how he embraced some of the most intolerant voices in this country.
Minnesota Democrat Ilhan Omar, who Trump and his supporters have directly targeted on many occasions, also made the case for impeaching Trump in strong words.
The president not only incited an insurrection against our government, but has in word and deed led a rebellion. We cannot simply move past this or turn the page. For us to be able to survive as a functioning democracy, there has to be accountability. We must impeach and remove this president from the office immediately so that he cannot be a threat to our democracy.
The House took up the impeachment vote just after Vice President Mike Pence spurned a resolution asking him to invoke the 25th Amendment and remove Trump from office. And the New York Times published an extraordinary account of the confrontation between Trump and Pence last week, where the president, using misogynist language, according to insider accounts, demanded that Pence, quote, can either go down in history as a patriot or you can go down in history as a pussy. Trump wanted Pence to abuse his ceremonial role of certifying the 2020 elections to enable him to seize power. Pence demurred. News broke on Tuesday that Trump's most powerful and ardent enabler, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, privately backs his impeachment. McConnell had decisively ensured Trump was acquitted of impeachment charges a year ago. According to the New York Times, now McConnell, quote, believes that Democrats' move to impeach him will make it easier to purge Mr. Trump from the party. Additionally, quote, a dozen Republican senators and possibly more could ultimately vote to convict Mr. Trump in a Senate trial that would follow his impeachment by the House. On Tuesday, the Justice Department held a press conference announcing that its investigation into the Capitol riot was unprecedented in scope. U.S. Attorney Michael Sherwin warned that many of the participants would face serious charges, including those related to sedition.
Regardless of if it was just a trespass in the Capitol or if someone planted a pipe bomb, you will be charged and you will be found. As the days go on, there's going to be more social media and people will recognize that in some instances, MPD and Capitol Police were in open-handed combat with some of these persons inside the Capitol, where tear gas was used on the Capitol Police and federal officers, and they were also used against some of these rioters. So the picture is going to build. I think there's a lot of misconceptions about what happened within the Capitol, and it's going to come into laser focus, I think, over the next weeks and days. And I think people are going to be shocked with some of the egregious contact that happened.
That's U.S. Attorney Michael Sherwin pointing out the massive scope of a federal investigation into the January 6th attack on the Capitol. A 70-year-old white man from Alabama named Lonnie Kaufman has already been indicted on 17 charges over his intent to distribute lethal weapons, including a truckload of Molotov cocktails and other firearms to rioters. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, in a social media post on Tuesday, explained that she got frighteningly close to danger herself on January 6th and feared for her life. She said that it was, quote, not an exaggeration to assert that many lawmakers were, quote, nearly assassinated that day. Her fellow Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley reports that the special panic buttons in her office had all been inexplicably torn out. Meanwhile, in an extraordinary letter to rank-and-file military personnel on Tuesday, the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff reminded them that Joe Biden will be president soon and that, quote, sedition and insurrection are illegal. Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy has just approved a 15,000 National Guardsmen to the Capitol ahead of Mr. Biden's inauguration, where more violence from Trump's base is expected. President Trump, whose bullhorn is getting smaller and smaller, has now been suspended for a week by YouTube, the last major social media platform that had allowed him to broadcast hate and incitement to his base. After companies like Facebook and Twitter had finally begun cracking down in earnest on far-right extremist content, many among Trump's base have fled to the darker corners of the internet to organize and plan more violence. Meanwhile, Trump continues to lose business over his insurrectionist actions. The city of New York just announced it is ending all contracts with the Trump Organization. In other news, just a day after a judge stayed her execution, the only woman on federal death row was killed by the state in the early hours of Wednesday. Lisa Montgomery, who was convicted of committing horrific crimes, was also a victim of serious and sustained sexual and physical abuse and sex trafficking as a child and struggled with mental illness. She became the first woman to be executed by the federal government in 67 years. Finally, in news from the coronavirus, the U.S. hit a new daily death toll on Tuesday. with more than 4,400 people dying in a 24-hour period, the highest ever total. And scientists in Ohio report that two new, more transmissible strains of the virus have been found to have likely originated in the U.S. This includes the new strain thought to have mutated in the U.K. On the bright side, a new study published in Science Journal concludes that once the vast majority of Americans are inoculated against COVID-19, the virus will become endemic, which means that it will remain circulating in the population but only cause mild symptoms. The faster people are vaccinated, the faster the pandemic is likely to become an endemic virus. And that does it for our news headlines. We'll be back with the rest of the show after this break. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The House of Representatives on Wednesday voted to impeach President Donald Trump over his role in inciting the Capitol riot last week that led to at least 5 deaths. Trump makes history for becoming the first president ever to be impeached twice. House Democrats moved with lightning speed to introduce an article of impeachment, debate it, and vote on it. What comes next as Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell remains surprisingly undecided about whether to vote on convicting Trump? And what does the impeachment mean for Trump and the future of the Republican Party? My guest is Jeet Heer, National Affairs Correspondent at The Nation. Among his latest articles is one entitled "The Enablers of Insurrection Should Be Ostracized." Welcome to the program, Jeet.
Good to be here.
So, are you surprised by the speed at which Democrats moved?
No, not really. I mean, I think I've always understood the point that impeachment is just a matter of political will. Honestly, they have moved very quickly. It's the fastest impeachment ever. But they could have even moved faster. There's nothing stopping Nancy Pelosi from introducing articles of impeachment last Thursday or Friday. So because it is just a matter, it's not like Sherlock Holmes, where you have to investigate, you know, who killed the Dowager and collect all the clues. This is a crime that occurred in front of everybody's eyes. Everybody saw Trump inciting the crowd and saw the crowd attack the Capitol building. So. It's a relatively simple matter, and the impeachment is really just an indictment. I'm glad that they did it, and they did move with, you know, relative speed for Congress, but it's not surprising.
Right. It's not a criminal investigation or criminal charge. It is a political act, and therefore it did not require even the week that they took. They could have actually, some have suggested, right after certifying the election results on Wednesday night, early Thursday morning, their next step could have been to introduce articles and vote on them. What do you make of some of the things that were discussed during the impeachment hearing? We have a handful of Republican congresspeople who voted to join Democrats in voting to impeach. Of course, it's not surprising that Representative Liz Cheney, Dick Cheney's daughter, voted for it because she was literally singled out by name by Donald Trump during his speech ahead of the Capitol riot. But do you have any thoughts on how many Republicans joined in and how many didn't?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a surprise in the House that it was only a handful. You have to remember, even after the attack on Capitol Hill, they 139, I believe, members of the House of Representatives who are Republican, all Republican, voted to not certify Joe Biden. As they accepted the logic of the people who stormed the Capitol.
And that was within hours of the attack when they were cleaning up the damage.
Exactly, yeah. In a building where, you know, you had literally had this mob rampaging just briefly, and where people died, you know, not long ago. So it's not surprising. I mean, the House is, for a variety of reasons. I mean, these are many of them in very gerrymandered districts that are very heavily Republican, and there's no percentage in them for making any sort of compromise. So that's not surprising. I think it is good that there are actually, let's say a handful. That's better than the last impeachment, and it does show that at least some Republicans, even in the House of Representatives, which is the closest body to him, are willing to break ranks. And I think the real question is, you know, the Senate.
I want to get to the Senate, but just staying on the House vote and some of the discussions that took place on Wednesday, you, of course, had the usual crowd. As you said, there's plenty of House Republicans who simply dug their heels in, repeated the lies about the election. And then you had others who did see fit to denounce the insurrection and Trump's role, but then turned around and said that the process was rushed, that it should have taken longer, and that now was the time for unity, not division. I mean, that's rich coming from Republicans, right?
No, it is. It is rich. And I think that I'm going to ask to see how bogus it all is, because there's no point in like rushing it. Like if you catch a shoplifter in the act of stealing, you know, like you don't say it's a rush to arrest them on the spot or to call the police on the spot. Everything happened before the eyes of the world. And so there's really nothing to investigate. You could drop an indictment just based on what Trump said and what happened. In terms of unity, I mean, that's like, there's nothing more divisive than what actually happened last Wednesday, which is like, you know, a president of the United States, you know, fomenting a mob to attack Congress. That's a divisive thing. So unless you address that, you're not going to get unity. You have to actually, you know, there's the old slogan, no peace, no justice, no justice, no peace. So one could suggest, say just as well, you know, there's no justice, no unity. And I think that, you know, justice has to be done, and we should see these arguments for what they are, which is just a kind of diversion or evasiveness. And that characterized the Republicans throughout the debates. I mean, the arguments against the impeachment were all just like, you know, what about ism? You know, what about Antifa? Like, as if that's the same thing.
Right.
So I think one can just easily dismiss them.
So you have a situation where Democrats impeached for the second time. And just about a year ago, the U.S. Senate, in a move led by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, voted to acquit Trump of the charges laid out in the two articles of impeachment voted on in December 2019. These were, of course, around quite a different scenario. It was an issue of corruption, abuse of power involving foreign policy, you know, the whole Ukraine scandal. Would it be fair to argue that the Senate had the chance to stop Trump? That acquittal emboldened Trump, and every pass that he has gotten from Republicans have simply emboldened him. And therefore, even though he has less than 10 days left in his tenure, not acting emboldens him.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. Like, I think that Trump is definitely someone who backs down when he's challenged and, you know, forges ahead when he's not. And there were Republicans who said after the earlier impeachment, well, Trump has learned his lesson. Even if he did something bad, he's learned his lesson and he won't do it again. Well, obviously, he didn't learn his lesson because he went on to do something even worse. So yeah, there has to be kind of punishment. And I think that the failure to to do that will like green light him. And I think more importantly, more dangerously, I think that, you know, if the Republicans really don't reject him through the Senate, then they are going to be in a situation where they're kind of stuck with Trump, because they have shown themselves that even when he does the most, like almost the worst thing one could imagine a president to do, they will still stick with him. And so therefore, he will remain the de facto head of the party.
So what do you make of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's position now? And of course, he doesn't remain Senate Majority Leader for very long, as the Georgia Senate races are being certified soon after that. It's not clear exactly when, but within maybe a week or so, the two Democratic senators from Georgia, Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff, will be seated, at which point it's up to Chuck Schumer, who becomes Senate Majority Leader, to decide what to do. And of course, it also depends on, before that, depends on Nancy Pelosi, when she decides to send the article of impeachment to the Senate. Any thoughts on what you think is, how you think things are going to unfold?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, it's hard to know. Not everyone is showing their cards. I mean, I think that McConnell has been playing a kind of double game where occasionally indicates he himself would support impeachment. He's in support removal, but now he's kind of wavering. And
the day before the impeachment, there were news headlines about McConnell privately backing impeachment because it would be an easier for him and the Republicans to get rid of Trump from their party, right? They just seem to have been playing this very dangerous game of trying to have it all, trying to use Trump for their political purposes, and now try to get rid of him in a political way without actually overtly doing so.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Yeah, I think that they want to, and that's what McConnell's been doing all along with Trump, trying to, you know, gain the whatever advantage he can get with in terms of tax cuts, judges. But, you know, not be held liable for Trump. I'm not sure if it's going to work for his advantage, but I think that in a lot of ways, McConnell also will try to use Trump to hurt the Democrats. I mean, from his point of view, maybe the best thing is to delay until, you know, Joe Biden is the presidential president, and then this can kind of poison the early days of Biden's presidency. Because, I mean, the more time you spend dealing with Trump, the less time you have with everything else on Biden's agenda. So I think that it's and that's why I think we don't know how Pelosi will carry on, but there is a kind of argument to be made, you know, like once the House gets the votes for impeachment, to just hold on to it and not bring it to the Senate until, like, you know, it doesn't have to be done right away if they don't have the votes, just do it like a couple of months from now.
A couple of months? I mean, do you think that that would not hamper the momentum that there is right now? Because, of course, the Democrats will only hold 50 seats in the Senate with Kamala Harris as a tiebreaker. They can eke out 51, but you need, what, 67 to convict an impeached president?
Yeah, no, and I think they'll have to do like a whip count to see how many votes that they have. But I actually honestly also think that the longer this goes on, the worse in some ways it is for Trump and for the Republicans, because I think more and more evidence is going to come out. There are criminal investigations going on right now. And what we've seen a pattern of is, like, in the first day, it was like, it just seemed like, oh, there are a bunch of clowns in makeup, you know, who are kind of like live action role playing, you know? They have their little swords and whatnot. But I mean, the more we find out, the more this seems like a serious criminal conspiracy where the lives of members of Congress were at threat. And I think that in some ways, we don't know all the facts and we don't know who's holding what cards, but there's a kind of argument to delay a little bit more, just, you know, so the facts look particularly bad for Trump.
So if the impeachment, if the article of impeachment is sent to the Senate, once there's more information, once investigations have been complete, once the federal government, federal investigation actually charges people, there'll certainly be more impetus to show the seriousness of the crime. But of course, it's Trump who's being impeached and presumably will be on trial, not the people involved on the ground, right? Isn't the challenge for the House and the Senate for lawmakers to link Trump and what he said and what he did to what's happened on the ground? And that's
sure,
all
yeah, but
out
it's
before
not
us.
A very hard link to make. I mean, Trump himself said, I'll go to the Capitol with you.
Yeah.
We have audio of the protesters telling police, you know, we were invited here by the president. And I think that the protesters, the rioters, you know, these are very lunkheads and they're criminals, But they actually have a point. The president of the United States said it was okay for them to go to the Capitol and to storm the building. So they just did what the president said. And if you're going to charge them, as you should, for crimes, but not charge the president, that seems very odd. Like, how would, that's like going after, you know, a mafia hitman, but ignoring the Godfather. How could you ignore the person that ordered this?
There is some sense that some senators will vote to impeach Trump. We know that in the last impeachment, the trial, the Senate trial, we had one Republican Senator Mitt Romney, I believe, voted on one of the two articles of impeachment. This time we have Lisa Murkowski potentially voting for it as well. And there are some reports that there could actually potentially be those 17 Republicans needed to join all Democrats to vote to convict Trump in a Senate trial. Now, the question becomes, whether senators might be more emboldened if they can do it secretly, or what, how much they really fear Trump or Trump's base. There was one congressman in an interview on MSNBC on Wednesday who said that his fellow Republicans are privately terrified of voting against Trump because they're worried they'll get death threats. And he said, well, welcome to the club. How do you respond to the sense that Republicans are would like to vote against Trump, but are terrified of him and or his base?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think that there's obviously an element of truth to that. But again, it's like, well, so what? I mean, like, AOC and Ilhan Omar get death threats all the time from the same people. So you're going to have to stand
so
for something.
So they can be bold enough to speak out, surely, Republicans? Yeah.
The Republicans should be as well. And I think further, I mean, I think that there's a death threat and there's also the sort of political threat. The fact is the Republican Party, you know, has these two wings of sort of traditional Paul Ryan type Republicans, country club Republicans, and they have this sort of new people, non-college whites, who have been energized and mobilized by Trump and who've joined the party because of Trump. And if they lose those new voters, then the party's going to be in big trouble. And I think that, you know, they don't want to alienate Trump and his followers because they fear that, you know, losing those voters is going to be the end of the party. And so I think that's the real political dynamic beyond the death threats. Like, they want Trump's voters, they don't want Trump. And the question is, how do you get to that position? And that's why, I mean, I think that there will be more Republicans than just Mitt Romney voting to remove, but I'm not sure if it's going to be that much more. And then I'm not sure it's going to be 17. I would be happily surprised if they get enough. I just think that the Republican Party is so tied to Trump that it's not so easy to separate from him.
And so let's talk about that. Where does the Republican Party go from here, regardless of what happens in the Senate? It seems clear, I think, to now at least a slim majority of Americans, if not a plurality, that what unfolded at the Capitol last week was unconscionable and intolerable. There are Republican voters posting videos on social media of themselves talking about how they think Trump should be immediately removed from office. Forget impeachment. They want the 25th Amendment or the 14th Amendment, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to be invoked. Doesn't the Republican Party risk it all if they do not alienate Trump? Or is our country so far down the Trump rabbit hole that Trumpism will have political support for a long time?
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, Trump has definitely lost popularity, but I mean, it's like, if you look at the aggregate polls, it's down from a peak of 44% to 40%. And so to me, that kind of indicates, you know, in some polls it's a little bit lower, 37, 35, but still, that would indicate the majority of Republicans are still with him. And I think the true Trump supporters are a minority in America, but they're a majority within the Republican Party. And that's a real problem. I mean, I think, you know, the loss of Twitter, the loss of Facebook will hurt him, be able to agitate his base. But, you know, I mean, he's, you know, someone who's traditionally had no difficulty in finding media outlets. And I think will remain a force within the Republican Party. And I mean, I think politically for the Democrats, one of the advantages of all this is that it forces that divide. It forces Republicans to take a stance on Trump, and it forces, you know, a division between those who stand with him and those who go against him, and that weakens the Republicans. But I honestly, it's hard for me to imagine. I think people are being premature in thinking that we've seen the end of Trump. I mean, even though he did this, and he did a really horrible thing, I think it's really telling that, like, he did this, and, you know, like, most Republicans in the House of Representatives won't vote to remove. And I think, you know, we don't know what's going to happen in the Senate, but there's so many senators who are going to stand with him.
I understand that it would only take a simple majority in the Senate for Democrats to ensure that Trump never holds office again. I don't know if you know enough about that, and if you think that that is a path for Democrats to take.
Remove and to definitely put a ban on Trump ever running for federal office, you need 67. They could. I mean, I think the reason why AOC and others are pushing the 14th Amendment is that they think that's a way around the two-thirds supermajority, to say, like, with a simple majority, we can use the 14th Amendment. And that could work, but I think if they do that, it's going to be litigated. It'll go to the Supreme Court. And I'm not sure what the Supreme Court will do.
So you are pessimistic about the future. It sounds that the Republican Party will not implode as a result of having hitched itself to Trump and Trumpism.
Oh, no, I think that the party is going to be wounded. It's going to be divided. Trump is going to be a divisive figure in the Republican Party. I just don't think that it's going to... there's going to be any quick separation or divorce. I think we're going to see years of civil war with the Republican Party. And we're seeing, like, you know, members of Congress who are still, like, more Trumpist than ever, you know, who are carrying guns or trying to carry guns on Capitol Hill, and who are going to really push that that type of politics. So I think that's going to be a real divide in the Republican Party. And I don't think there's going to be any easy, quick separation from Trump.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Jeet, for joining us today. Is thenation.com the best place to read your writings?
Yes, it is. Yes. And on Twitter at herejeet.
We'll post a link to both of those from our website. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good to be here.
My guest has been Jeet Heer, National Affairs Correspondent at The Nation. Among his latest articles at The Nation is one entitled "The Enablers of Insurrection Should Be Ostracized." And we've been discussing the second impeachment of Donald Trump. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The Capitol riot on January 6th has left lawmakers and many in the nation rattled. Progressive Democrat Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, among others, have said that she came close to imminent danger and even assassination. As more details of the attack come to light, it appears clear that the situation could have been far worse. Pipe bombs that inexplicably did not go off were found at the headquarters of both the Democratic and Republican National Committees on the same day. Armed men were readying a distribution of weapons and Molotov cocktails. More violence is being planned for the coming week. It is in this context that a bill aimed at curbing domestic terrorism by Congressman Bill Schneider that was passed by the House last fall is being revived. But critics worry that such an act, if passed into law, will only further erode civil liberties and curb legitimate protest. My guest is Branko Marchteach, staff writer at Jacobin Magazine and a 2019-2020 Leonard C. Goodman Institute for Investigative Reporting Fellow. His book is Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. We had discussed that book with him on our program. He just published a new piece called We Don't Need New Terror Laws to Defeat the Far Right. Welcome back to the program, Branko.
Thanks for having me back.
So you start your piece citing Senator Tom Cotton, a Republican, who rightfully earned scorn last year when he called for federal troops to attack protesters involved with Black Lives Matter. Now, Tom Cotton has, unlike many of his Republican colleagues, actually been consistent and pointed out that he remains firm that insurrectionists should face the worst consequences or the strongest, harshest response possible. He published a statement that was then carried by the Wall Street Journal, where he said that those who attacked the Capitol should face the full extent of federal law. He referred to them as insurrectionists. So shouldn't we applaud the fact that a Republican is actually consistently applying the same standards to right-wing extremists as they have done to activists on the left?
Well, I think the question itself points out some of the problem here, which is that I think we have to be concerned when someone like Tom Cotton, someone who, as you say, in 2020 published this much derided op-ed basically calling for the military to mow down anti-police brutality protesters under similar sort of reasoning, that there were protesters, a small minority of them, that did property damage, burnt down a police station, for instance, or attacked family-owned stores and the like. There were a small amount of protesters then who were engaged in violence against police, in one case, at least one case, even a lawmaker. And so at the time, Cotton's op-ed was really, if not laughed out of the room, was met with quite a lot of alarm.
The New York Times got into big trouble for publishing it.
That's right. There was an editor that had to resign. There was a revolt among the newsroom, and for good reason, because Cotton was lumping in peaceful protest and calling it insurrection and putting it under the same banner as that small minority of people that was doing violence. And for him, the point was he wanted to use overwhelming force to put down civil unrest in general. And while that was really criticized at the time, he has published essentially the exact same op-ed. Not in the words, of course, the words are a little bit different, but the point is the same and the target is very much the same. And he himself is very happy in the article because he says, well, I see now that people, liberals who criticized me the first time, and now that it's a different set of protesters, they have changed their minds and actually they now want force to be used once again on protesters. And it encompasses what I see as an emerging consensus, which is that not to take a narrow, limited approach here where you go after and prosecute and try and uncover the plot for organized violence that appears to have been at the heart of this, or at least like a part of the protest, but to actually encompass the entire idea of protesting, occupying the Capitol, entering the Capitol, and even ensnare the people who simply were walking around. I may have committed property damage or may have done nothing but take selfies and sort of count them as terrorists. There are people like Matthew Iglesias who are saying if we curb this stuff on the right, it'll be good because then we can later curb any sort of civil unrest on the left if there's another wave of massive anti-police brutality protests.
So shouldn't the response to that be No, there's a huge distinction between what the left is calling for and what the right is calling for. You know, the left is asking for police and authorities to respect lives and respect human rights, and the right is calling for something veering on ethnic cleansing.
Well, ethnic cleansing, perhaps. Certainly, that's how Cotton's op-ed kind of sounds like. Also, the protesters that he was talking about were not always people of color. They also happened to be white people as well. There were a lot of white protesters. So, I mean, I think for Cotton, it's more the traditional Republican law and order argument. The idea of, insurrection was something that was used to describe, for instance, the Watts riots and some of the other riots and various actions that were happening during the 60s and the 70s. The problem is that when we talk about terrorism, I mean, what are we really talking about? The right to, say, occupy a capital, even though I disagree entirely with what these people are doing, they were doing this for an anti-democratic reason, to keep a far-right president in power when he had lost an election. So the political reason behind the protest was bad. The right to occupy a building, to go into a Capitol building, that's one that has been used by progressive and left-wing protesters for years.
It was, but not to the point of breaking windows of the Capitol. Sure, there's in Minneapolis, protesters burned down the police department, always ensuring that there weren't actual human beings involved. I've never heard, and certainly we see like groups like Code Pink having gone in and disrupting Senate hearings and using their free speech rights and engaging in civil disobedience, paying the price for that, remaining peaceful, not breaking certainly hurting people. I mean, it seems to me that what we saw last week at the Capitol was of an entirely different nature, and equating what the right did with what the left might someday want to do is quite dangerous to the left.
Well, I mean, that equation is already made. Like I said, Tom Cotton is the one who says, now people are on board with me. And I mean, there's not really a good distinction that you can make. The organized violence, the possible kidnappings, yes, that is something unique to this, and obviously should be prosecuted with the full force of the law. But when you're talking about breaking windows and doing property damage, well, again, that is exactly the kind of things that the right was saying, to say that Black Lives Matter protesters in 2020 were insurrections. So I think we have to be careful about where we direct our outrage and what we're describing, because the really alarming stuff here was, one, those possible plots of organized violence to kidnap or possibly kill lawmakers, number one. Secondly, I think we also have to look at the fact that there were some very concrete security failures here, right, that led to the storming of the Capitol. Thirdly, there's the possible complicity of the police. We know that police officers were involved in the riot. We know that Capitol police officers, in some cases, let people in, took selfies. Some have been fired or suspended because of their actions. And we know also that police sheriffs and other people in leadership positions around the country have expressed support for what happened.
Many of them traveled to Washington, D.C. to participate in the riot.
Yeah, exactly. And so there is a common thread, I think, between the police violence, the police brutality we saw through 2020 against Black Lives Matter protesters, and the police's seeming complicity, which I hope will be investigated fully in this event. And to me, it is quite alarming that the idea that the way to deal with this is to give more power to the police, give more power for them to be able to prosecute people and spy on people and the like under a domestic terrorism statute, when they themselves are part of the reason why this event happened. So I think we have to really think about what is the most effective response here, instead of just going to repeating the mistake of September 11, and another a terrorist attack where thousands of people were killed. And what happened was, instead of taking a targeted approach against Al-Qaeda and other terrorists. There was a sweeping massive surveillance state that was set up in this anti-terrorism law, the Patriot Act, that empowered the FBI and law enforcement to spy on people. And that was ultimately not directed, for the most part, against those terrorists. It was directed at law-abiding Muslims, drug dealers, anti-war activists, and so on and so forth. So I think we have to think about outcomes here, and what the potential unwanted ramifications are going to be of taking this kind of line that Tom Cotton is so happy about.
The September 11th attacks and what came after, I think, are the closest analogy we can make to what happened last week and what is likely to come after those Capitol riots. People, not only has the country been traumatized, but now, of course, as you suggested, there is this legislative response that I think lawmakers feel they have to make in order to seem like they're doing something. So, of course, we have the impeachment of Donald Trump, but then is there a clear case that can be made that we do not need any domestic terrorism laws, because whatever we have on the books are sufficient to use to respond to last week, and in fact ought to even be pulled back a little bit?
I mean, no one I've seen has really explained what exactly a domestic terrorism law, how it would have helped. I mean, this was planned out in the open. People knew about it. We know now that the FBI, first of all, warned some people not to go because they had seen some of the things they were saying online, and they were saying, you know, if you go and participate in this, it will not be worth your while. We know the FBI told the Capitol Police about this. We know that there were many, many warnings, and that the Capitol Police ultimately did not prepare for it. Not only for the scale of what it ended up being, but even for in the way that they would with any other protest. And, you know, as I said, that should be investigated. I mean, I think one of the things that we're not talking about is how can we have the right response to this if we don't even know yet what happened?
Right.
Why is it that the Capitol Police was so unprepared? Why is it that the Pentagon was so unwilling to send in its own troops? Why, for instance, was the National Guard blocked from coming? We have some public statements from people explaining these things, but we don't really have a good idea, and we don't really know to what extent, if there's any complicity. And I feel like we should probably know that before we start, moving to kind of just criminalize or put down dissent and protest. So I think that this is one of the things that we have to think about is doing a really full inquiry. Someone, for instance, has already talked about a 9/11 commission style inquiry into what happened, which I think makes sense. Have an independent body look at this, investigate this, and figure out what actually went wrong, because it would be a tragedy if, like September 11, another product of a clear, avoidable security failure, what ends up happening is this heavy-handed response that is instead going to be used by law enforcement to, you know, crack down on climate change protesters, Black Lives Matter protesters, and so on and so forth.
Let's actually look at the content of the law, the act rather, that is being discussed. Last year, the House passed this bipartisan bill, the Domestic Terrorism Prevention Act, was introduced by Representative Brad Schneider. And of course, because of Mitch McConnell controlling the Senate, it went nowhere. But this particular bill, Representative Schneider first makes the case that white supremacist violence is the biggest internal threat facing the country, which of course has been confirmed by our own federal intelligence agencies, and then went on to explain that this bill would enable or authorize Homeland Security, the Justice Department, and the FBI to monitor, investigate, and prosecute cases of domestic terrorism, and then went on to talk about information sharing. And it just sort of surprises me. All of this sounds like what was already encompassed in the USA Patriot Act and in the Homeland Security Act. Of course, I'm not a legislative expert, but in broad strokes, what this bill is calling for appears to have already been on the books. It's just that it wasn't being applied in a consistent manner because, of course, white supremacists have been given a pass for so long compared with people of color who might be perpetrating crimes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, trying to potentially take hostage and kill elected officials and police and others, that is already a crime. It is not as if there is nothing on the books that makes this illegal. And as you say, there's a lot of powers that law enforcement already has, you know, arguably too much to go after what was ostensibly meant to be terrorists, but of course in reality ended up being people who maybe expressed anti-war sentiments or you know, happened to have other criticisms of the Bush administration, or, you know, just happened to belong to demographics that were considered suspect by law enforcement. So Muslim communities, Black communities, and so on and so forth. You know, there was a story this week about how there's an app for that Muslims use for prayer that basically was taking their location data and a whole host of other information, selling it among the clients being the US government. Do we really, given the fact that we just had Donald Trump as president, and you know, there's no guarantee that either Trump won't be president again, given that he plans to run, or someone with similar sympathies, given that the Republican Party is very much in line with Trump on a lot of things, particularly his hostility to Muslims and immigrants. And do we really trust the next Donald Trump or the next Tom Cotton or the next Ted Cruz, the people that currently are quite rightfully being pilloried in the media? Do we really trust them to enforce such a law responsibly, to designate only the organizations that we think are terrorist organizations as terrorist organizations? I, for one, don't. And after watching the events of last year, where there was such, first of all, alarm and then later relief that Trump's threat of declaring Antifa a terrorist organization could not be followed through because he did not have a domestic terror law with which to do it, it makes no sense to me now, given that, to start talking about giving the government the power to do that so that when the next Trump comes in, he can do that.
And again, interestingly, this domestic terrorism prevention act that was passed by the House last year was supported by Muslim Advocates, which is a civil rights organization, the NAACP, the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, the Southern Poverty Law Center Action Fund, Unidos Sikh Coalition, the Human Rights Campaign, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, Jewish Action, Bend the Arc, Arab American Institute, Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism. I mean, these are many, many progressive organizations or organizations that would consider themselves progressive. Why do you think they backed this law?
I mean, I think part of it is that there is an alarm over white supremacist violence, and which is completely understandable. Of course, white supremacist and far-right violence is the most prevalent type of political violence in the world, and certainly in the United States. It's not Muslims and other groups. So I think part of that is it's an understandable desire to protect oneself in the same way that people saw a understandably a threat to their lives and safety from the September 11 attacks, and they thought, well, you know what, it's worth maybe pushing the boundaries here if it means that we're going to keep our families safe.
Not as much on the left, though. There were some liberal groups, absolutely, and Democrats who were, you know, just as vehement as the Republicans at going after people who are perceived as terrorists. But a lot, the majority of the left, especially in the grassroots, were terrified about the backlash and the way in which the anti-terror laws would be implemented, and with good reason. We've seen in the years since how many Muslim Americans, immigrants, people of color in general became victims of these laws. But do you think, I'm wondering finally, Marco, do you think what we really need is more of a cultural conversation? You can't legislate the end of white supremacy, but we can start through grassroots organizing, through education, through speaking out and organizing on the left, change our culture to give no quarter to white supremacy and far-right extremism. Isn't that the longer-term, harder work that's needed now?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, what's going to change this is a political solution. What has to happen? It would be great if we could just say, you know what, Republicans and the hard right, you just don't get to run elections or be lawmakers anymore. You know, you could potentially pass a law like that. It would be very authoritarian, but it would be a very quick fix. The thing is, though, that's not going to solve the problem, which is why people with these kinds of ideas have power. And ultimately, yeah, they have to be politically defeated and replaced. And it has to be a political shift, which, as you say, is a much harder thing to do because it means winning elections and organizing in the bottom up, at the local level, at the state level, and so on and so forth. That's painstaking work that takes a very long time. I think, though, it's not only a cultural conversation we have to have. I think there are specific things that we can look at here, you know, including, again, if at no other time, this should be a wake-up call that the policing in the United States needs to have a broad-based inquiry, and those far-right, anti-democratic elements of the police need to be rooted out. People with those ideas should not be, I think it's uncontroversial to say, the ones policing and you know, upholding the safety and law and order. I think we can look at what exactly happened with the security failures. You know, Ayanna Pressley, she says that as she was being escorted out of her office, she went to press the panic button in her office, and the panic buttons have been ripped out. It's things like that. They're hints that maybe there's something bigger going on here that clearly needs to have to be independently investigated, not by necessarily the Capitol Police, who, you know, themselves are under question, but by someone independent. And I think we can look at things like, without resorting to censorship, I think you can change, for instance, algorithms and social media so that they don't lead people down a far-right pipeline constantly. I think we can look at things like maybe using, finally, the anti-monopoly powers to basically dismantle these massive media conglomerates that have ended up in things like Fox News and other conservative outlets that dominate the airwaves.
Right, Facebook and is facing such an investigation and a probe. Yeah.
Exactly, and I think that there's no reason to stop at social media, because television as well is another part of this, and that's kind of been left out of the conversation entirely. So I think there's ways you can. You know, go about this and prevent something like this happening, or at least prevent more people from being frankly lied to and radicalized, not necessarily by censorship, but by basically just you know, either affirmative measures like reinstating the fairness doctrine or reducing the power of these massive media entities. So, you know, I think we should have a conversation about all of that, instead of just taking this reflexive attitude of, oh, well, political violence happens, so that what we have to do is we have to pass a domestic terrorism law and give more power to the police that we suspect were maybe involved. You know, and the last thing I'll say is, even if this particular bill, the one that you mentioned, is not especially controversial, at the end of the day, this bill is going to go through several rounds of negotiation and rewriting, and there'll be things slipped into it. The devil is always in the details, and what we find at the very end, the product that comes out, may have things that are far more objectionable in it by the time it's done than what was in it to begin with in its draft form.
Well, Branko, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to your piece about this story from our website. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
My guest has been Branko Marchtich. He's a staff writer at Jacobin Magazine and a 2019-2020 Leonard C. Goodman Institute for Investigative Reporting Fellow. His book is called Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. You can watch the interview we did with him about that book on our website. And we've just now been discussing the debate around new domestic terrorism laws in the wake of the Capitol riot. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on Facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.